Busy city life makes it hard to think about and work at integrating our faith with our lives. Welcome to the Cathedral Podcast, produced and hosted by Jenny Ho Huan. Each episode, we want to help you relate core Christian truths to your daily life. Whether it's science, philosophy, cultural trends, or life stories, we bring you authentic and unrehearsed conversations to spark insight and strengthen your faith and your life.
Hello, everyone. This is Jenny. You know, life never unfolds in a straight line. Some of the tangents and even zigzags, which we would rather not have, may include leaping into the unknown for our work or battling a chronic illness. Indeed, many of us will, at some point in our life, confront challenges we can't always prepare for. Wendy Wong is here to share her story with us, and I believe you will be blessed by it. Hi, Wendy.
Thanks very much, Jenny. So glad to be here.
So glad you can be with us. I just got to know you like over two years ago at a conference. And the thing that really struck me when I saw you at the conference doing your work, which is visual recording, and after that we managed to go and have a short lunch, was just your gusto for life, you know. You were attacking your lunch like and just enjoying it and all that. And all that was happening while I didn't know your story, your background, your journey. So the more I knew about your life, the more it struck me how unlikely it is that you are who you are. So there must be a story. So I'm sniffing that story out today right here with everyone. So let me start with a couple of questions to get us to know you better. Visual recording, okay? Many people don't know what that is. So unpack that a little bit for us and how you ended up doing this.
Okay. So visual recording, simple summary of that. If you break down that term, visual and recording, visual refers to the use of graphics. In the case of this particular kind of work, it is an integration of words and pictures, and recording meaning documentation.
Right.
So visual recording is actually a set of approaches, a way of listening to people, people who are giving presentations, or sometimes it's in a group conversation. And what we do through visual recording is not so much to take verbatim notes, but to capture key patterns of thinking, of ideas, of questions, and also people's dreams and hopes and fears and their futures.
So you are listening to the content, but also listening to something between the lines.
Yes.
Okay, so I have a funny question. Have you ever recorded a session and then you realize that the speaker is not very coherent and then you are feeling like, you know, because there's an interpretation going on in your mind too. How do you grapple with that? Because you have to basically, the documentation forces you to not put in your own inputs, right? Yeah. So how do you grapple with that?
In visual recording, we do our best to mirror what's in the room. So simply put, we go where the speaker goes, and we also go where the group goes. And I think part of that service to the group is precisely in that neutral mirroring. So for instance, in a group conversation, sometimes it's not easy for a group to understand the complex environment that they're operating in.
Yep.
Right? Just like for us, we do need to talk with people. We do need to think it through almost in a circular way before sometimes we reach a certain breakthrough or we are able to identify what's in the white space, literally and figuratively, to get to maybe some insight or some important question that we need to address. And so a good visual recording will reflect that, will reflect the fact that the group did take some effort, did struggle, did need some time to go around, as it were, some of the maybe peripheral issues or factors before they hit something.
Wow.
Yeah. Instead of trying to mask and say, oh, it was a direct, linear route.
Yeah. So that's really powerful. So at the end of it, the group gets to see the thing that you have recorded.
Yes.
And the impact will then be?
Well, not just at the end. Certainly at the end, when they have the finished artifact, they can use it as a memory. Also to continue conversations outside of that setting.
Yeah.
But during the session itself, especially if it's a longer session, say a day or two over a retreat, they are able to go to that chart and allow that chart to show them and give them instant feedback on where they are.
Yeah, that's
powerful. We're grappling with this. Oh, we still have this unanswered question at this corner of the chart. We should come back to it.
Wow.
And literally the writing is on the wall.
Exactly. As well as the drawing.
Yes.
Yeah, and all the connections. Yes. And that's very fascinating. So much better than, say, taking minutes of meetings, I think.
Or complimentary.
Complimentary.
Yeah.
I think minutes of meeting will cover certain things, but that's very fascinating. So when people look at it, they may just go, oh, wow, that was also mentioned. And sometimes in the conversation, there's too many conversations, multiple conversations going on, and people are not catching it. So that's a really challenging job. What would you say is a core skill in that job then?
Listening.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. So being very attentive to what happens in the room and also being willing to listen to whoever is speaking.
That's very fascinating. Mm. I'm going to come back to that because listening is something so lacking in our world today. Just being able to listen to ourselves, listen to God and listen to each other.
Yeah.
Okay. So guys, if you're listening to this and you still don't quite know what visual recording is, of course, there's always Mr. Google to check it out. Or you can visit Wendy's Facebook. Okay. Or go to her website, Millennia Studios. Okay. Now, you did not always do this though. I mean, and in fact, you never really considered yourself very creative. So how did you land up doing this? What happened? Where was God in this story somewhere?
Absolutely. I was actually on the year of no pay leave.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, I had been working in a government agency for quite a while.
Yeah.
And towards the end of that year on no pay leave, the idea came that I might consider doing something different instead of going back to that full-time job. And I had already taken some training in visual recording skills. So that came out as an option.
Right.
By suggestion. So I prayed. Really wanted to know whether that was God's will for me. Like, that's a very common question.
Yeah.
We often ask, right, at the crossroads, you know, God, what is your will for me?
Mm.
And I was doing my regular devotions and over a period of time coming close to when no pay leave would be ending and I needed to go back to HR and say, this is my choice. I read Jeremiah 29 and Ecclesiastes 3. So usually when I share this part of the story with people, right, and they go jump and say, oh, verse 11, you know, I know the
but
plans.
It's
and
not.
I say, no, it's not. It's not at all.
Okay.
I was actually more struck by 70 years, which is mentioned in the passage. And I never noticed that number there before.
Mm-hmm.
But during that time when I was reading, that number really stood out for me. And I didn't take it literally, though.
Of course.
Yeah, not
you
70 years.
You are definitely not 70 yet.
So it's like, wow, I have to wait so long. 70 years is a long time. But I read it as, wow, I have a God of precision. God is very precise. You know, he writes very specifically, 70 years. He's so confident. So there must be a very specific beginning and ending to the season which he has full knowledge of, even though I'm not aware of it.
That's quite an insight indeed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that I think was of great assurance that this is a God of precision who loves me and who is taking care of me. And from Ecclesiastes 3, because it is about vanity, so I thought about it for quite a while as well. And the main thing that came up for me was the illusion of permanence and the reality of pride or vanity.
Yeah.
So I just held those two things. And what came through for me, which I recognized because there was a sense of peace and lightness, that regardless of whatever choice I was going to make, whether it is to return back to the government work I had been doing before, or to come out and try something entirely new, which I really don't know very much about, and do a life experiment, as it were. The main issue was still the illusion of permanence and the reality of pride or vanity. You know, whichever choice you make, what is your motivation for making it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because you think this is going to give you life security? Or is it because you're going to get a lot of fame and popularity and you think people will love you better in this particular place of work? So those were the core issues which were the same for both choices. And that was quite liberating. The other somewhat frustrating thing was that in the decision-making process, God did not give a clear yes or no. I wish he did.
I know, we all do. But I think you did get to something deeper than just a yes or no.
No, it's true. So I'm very grateful for that. So basically, what I felt was coming through was God saying, oh, you can choose.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, if you choose to do this, I will be with you. And if you choose to do that, I will be with you too. So go ahead, you are free to choose. And of course, at that point in time, I wasn't kind of as settled yet. I was like, this is not very helpful. I actually do want you to tell me quite specifically whether I should do this or that. But he didn't. So in the end, I made my choice. And I think the fact that I went through this process with the two passages and with the kind of reflections that I did has helped me throughout the close to 8 years now that I've been running my practice. It's helped me in the sense that when things are going well, I try to remember not to let it get to my head.
Right.
And when things are going not so well, I try to remember not to let it get to my heart. Because there is a precise beginning and ending to the season, including this season of stewarding this practice. I try to keep that in mind, so it's a dynamic balance, as it were.
Yes, yes. So neither inflated nor deflated be, as it were.
Yeah.
Okay, try to stay in that space of equanimity. But it's not just that also, because even before this decision and all that, you had been battling with a medical condition. And how does that play into your decision-making as well? And how did you journey through that? Because tell us more about lupus.
So lupus is an autoimmune condition.
Mm.
Autoimmune conditions are situations where the body is unable to discriminate between the viruses and the foreign antibodies that come in, which destroy the body. So in the case of an autoimmune patient, the immune system will just react and almost, as it were, kill everything in sight, including own body tissues.
Right.
And that creates symptoms like inflammation, but it can get a lot more severe than that.
Mm.
And the form of lupus that I have is systemic, meaning that it affects full body systems. For some patients, it means the digestive system. For some others, it affects the nervous system. Some people have a discoid form, which is skin. And no two patients present the same way.
Yeah.
And even for a single patient, the symptoms change over a lifetime. So it is also commonly called the disease of a thousand faces.
Wow, I did not know that. And that really does sound like something very hard to accept and manage, isn't it?
It's quite unpredictable, whimsical. So being attentive to how the condition shows up in daily life is extremely important.
Wow. Okay, so how many years now since you were diagnosed with?
This year will be my 21st year.
21, wow. I'm sure that there were some points where it was just really hard and it was low. It like probably beat you to the ground kind of thing. I don't know whether you mind sharing with us how you weathered through those times and how did you emerge being such a joyful being?
I think the early years were very difficult. Typically, in the first few years, the condition needs also some time to stabilize. This is a generalization, of course, because every patient is different. But I do remember in the first 8 to 10 years, several times needing to be hospitalized, not being able to get a very good handle on my particular case, how I manifest in terms of symptoms. Even up to today, if you ask some of the doctors who attend to me, they feel like it's a bit hard to get a handle on what is the right dosage of the different drugs. And we keep adjusting.
Right.
Sometimes we make a little bit of progress in terms of the clinical indicators getting better.
Mm.
And just when you think it's getting better, you know, it something happens. And
it's a condition that keeps you on your toes in some ways.
Oh, very much.
How do you not be in a state of anxiety with a condition like that? How has your journey been?
Gratitude is a very big part of my daily habit. I've learned over time to celebrate small normals. I think not just in lupus, but maybe lupus is a great motivator because it's with me all the time, but it's extended to every other part of my life too. So one practice that I've had, and this would be my 11th year already doing that, is to write down at the end of every day things that I'm grateful for.
So the gratitude journal.
Yes, the gratitude journal. Regardless of time of the night, it's always the last thing that I do in the day. And it's a simple thing, just open up a Word document and just begin a sentence, thankful for or thankful to be. And just recount the day.
Right.
It's almost like a examine kind of process. And just review the day without judging. What happened? Where did I go? Who did I meet? How did God show up?
Right.
And just write those things down and really count my blessings. And I think over that 10 years of doing this, it has blessed me a lot to remember these things. And when things go bad, as they often do, you have bad days, open up something like a gratitude journal, look back at how God has been faithful, how He has brought people along, how He has also given me the opportunity to be part of people's lives and to witness Him at work in their lives. That's always of great consolation.
Mm. Yeah, I think ultimately there comes a point where we realize our life is just really about what we have lived it for, no matter what we have to live through. But if you have something to live for, it makes what you have to live through more livable. You know, the Bible has this exhortation, right, where Paul says, in everything give thanks. And I believe, just like me, I'm just, at some point in our life when we were younger, it was like, this is a very unreasonable thing to ask. How can we possibly give thanks for everything? But as your gratitude journal practice, discipline rather shows, it's actually more about learning to spot things and realize that this can be something you could give thanks for, which maybe normally you wouldn't. Because we skim through life, we live so fast that, and but when we start collecting the things that we can be thankful for, slowly it changes us to be even be able to be thankful for the really hard things.
Sue Monkitt has this really nice quote from her book, The Sacred Ordinary.
Mm.
She wrote that she realized at one point that God isn't partial to stained glass. So God is present everywhere, right? We like to say no sacred secular divide. And this is also other thought that God does want and does use all the material of our lives.
Mm.
And so if that is all true,
yeah.
Why should we not be looking out for God showing up in every day and not just in the places where we expect to find Him?
Exactly.
Because He cannot be contained.
Yes, yes.
Much bigger than our imaginations and our understanding.
Yeah.
But also, I'm no saint. So in my gratitude journal, I'm not just all rejoicing over things, you know, and having such a pleasant view of stuff. I mean, some days my gratitude are, I'm thankful that not every day is like today.
Mm.
It's really been horrible.
Right. Yeah.
And it's just a level of honesty also, which the gratitude journal allows for.
Yeah, I think that's really good. It's important not to do a spiritual discipline in order to just keep the discipline and then force ourselves to, you know, like beat ourselves into a particular religious shape, right, as it were. Like, I have to be this grateful person. But rather just be real and engage the practice and allow the practice to shape us over time. What about church and friends, as you have been journeying for, what, 2 decades with this illness? How has that been? Has it been helpful, unhelpful? What should people not say to someone with a chronic illness?
I feel that one of the best things that friends and the church can do is to grow in and cultivate the posture of waiting.
Mm.
So chronic illness involves a lot of waiting.
Yeah.
In the case of an autoimmune condition like lupus, there is currently no cure.
Yeah.
So the best that we can do is to manage the symptoms.
Mm.
And there's so much that we can do
to
have a good posture of waiting together.
Such as?
So the first level, I feel, is in terms of living the Christian year. So liturgical time.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. We have a podcast episode on Lent. Liturgical calendar. Tell us more about what it means to read together.
Yeah. I really enjoy living the Christian year. I try my best to pay attention to the different seasons that we live through. Mm-hmm. And I do feel after maybe 3 years or so of paying more attention this way, that we truly are enlarged in the waiting.
Mm.
I think that comes from the Message translation, right? Mm. We are enlarged in the waiting. We learn to wait with hope because we have a sure future.
Right.
And we also learn to live time as a story that has meaning. Mm. Of course, this is God's story that we learn and we're reminded about.
Yeah.
All those postures are very important and certainly have a very positive effect on then responding to chronic illness. And that's something that we do corporately. We do it in so many ways. Through the word, through music, and then through different kinds of devotional readings and through our meetings together. That is something we should definitely continue. It can be of so much encouragement and strength to people who are going through any kind of difficulty.
So the community just doing what the community regularly does, being faithful at it, engaging it meaningfully and welcoming the person. And just, you know, I think it creates that stability, right? When you're going through so much unpredictability in your life, and then you're able to go to a church, a community, and say, oh, I know at Saturday this group of people will be here doing this, and I can come and they will welcome me, even if I can't fully participate or whatever, or I'm in pain, and I can still be a part of something going on that I know is meaningful, that somehow when I come away from it, I will be renewed in a special way.
The coming in, I mean, as you speak, the coming in strikes me as in the present moment. This is the posture that we take of openness, of hospitality. I think that corporate waiting together, right, living in liturgical time, is also a posture of returning, returning to God.
Yeah.
Because in the case of illness, sometimes you can look back on your past and you can ask questions like, what if?
Yes.
If only I did this, if only I didn't do that, you know, would I not? Maybe I won't be sick now if I had done this or not done that. Yeah. But all those kinds of things are not helpful. Your situation is what it is. Corporate waiting, waiting together as a church, is intentionally deciding that our posture of returning is returning to God.
You're right.
We remember everything God has done before. We remember His character as revealed, as He has revealed to us. And you choose very intentionally what you will focus your mind and your heart on when you return to the past, as it were. So there's the present and the past, but there's also a future. Because our liturgical time, living the year this way, is to take our imagination in a certain direction.
Which that's is towards, a very good way of putting it,
towards a certain reality. Instead of all the possible alternative futures you could think of. Right?
Yeah.
So you try and extrapolate your illness and you think, I'm doomed. Or you try to deny that the illness is there and say, no. I'm going to live an awesome life. I'm going to pretend this illness is not here. Either one of these, whether you
actually
are
delusional, actually.
They're delusions. But the church has such a powerful role in in really taking the imagination and say, train it, and leave it onto that truest reality and future.
That's a very powerful thing you're sharing with us, because every one of our life feels so real to us and so immediate. And it's so easy to be you know, taken in by it and so absorbed and overwhelmed in it that we forget that, like you say, our time is actually story, that our stories are part of a larger story, God's story, that is that ultimate reality. And if we take our story and then, you know, kind of like juxtapose it against God's, and then we know that God's story is He's the author, He's the finisher of our faith. There's a beginning, there's an end. You know, all the intervening chapters, God is writing with intention and with love. And when you keep going back to that place, right? I mean, that's just so... it anchors you and it's so powerful.
Yeah.
Am I getting what you're trying to say?
Yeah, that's right. And that posture, right, of hopefulness, anticipation, even celebration, if you like. I think there's also a second part to it. Which is to role model and to learn the language of lamenting. So that maybe takes the whole, how can friends and church help, and this posture of waiting down to a more personal level, which I like to think of being radical accompaniment. So I think of it radical in the sense of fundamental and also in the sense of shockingly different and better way.
Yes.
Of being with people in difficulty. Yeah.
Rather than being with them and either trying to distract them or minimize their pain or all that discomfort that normally comes with such situations, but actually just really being with them.
Yes, being with
waiting
them.
With them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you mention things like the church being really an open community and people who are struggling, whether with illness or other kinds of things that they might be afraid about or they feel angry about, they feel shameful about, they know that they can come into a community and be accepted where they are.
Yeah.
You don't want to stay where you are, because if that's an unhealthy place, you want to kind of move from that. But certainly you come in knowing that you are seen. So it parallels visual recording work, actually, because visual recording work is very much about witnessing people.
Yes.
And a powerful effect when people who sometimes otherwise feel unheard see their words being written on a large paper and saying, my voice is there, my opinion counts. So in terms of radical accompanying people who struggle, say chronic illness, there are several things that can help. May not be verbalized that way, but sometimes the actions and little things you do can speak louder. But some things I feel has helped me is when people say or do things that bring the message that I love you the same.
Mm.
Before you were diagnosed, after you're diagnosed, on your good days, when you feel okay, on your bad days, when you're impossible to live with, I love you the same. Secondly, that you are not a lesser person for this.
Mm.
In the case of lupus, on those days where there is a flare and your symptoms are bad, you can be mentally very active, still very sharp, but your body just cannot get up to do things, and it is very frustrating.
Yeah.
You really feel as if you are reduced to nothing.
Mm, mm.
And that can be both terrifying as well as very frustrating.
Yes, yes.
Mm. Yeah, it can trigger you to think about all kinds of very bad scenarios. Mm. Like, oh, what if this continues? What am I going to do? I'm a lousy person. And all that kind of stuff. So to have people around you who can, in those moments, be able to bring that message to you. You are still a whole person. You're not lesser just because you are so-called unproductive.
Right.
Or you're lying around doing nothing, having to wait for this storm to pass. So that's another thing that helps. I think a third thing that helps is when people are honest about the fact that they don't understand. They don't understand and they feel helpless looking at you having this condition and having to work through it and with it. The honesty helps much better than trying to say, oh, I have a relative who has a friend who has exactly this condition.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it helps to know that there are other people struggling and you're not alone. But more often, it's just better in that moment for someone to say, wow, this is really hard. I don't get it.
And sometimes
what strangely enough helps is when someone decides to attend to you with thoughtful neglect.
What does that mean?
Not to smother you with love,
right?
But to say we are going to carry on life normally.
Sure,
you have a chronic illness and it can be pretty hard. It's rather unpredictable, temperamental. We don't know what's going to happen. But okay, as far as we know, life goes on as normal. I'm going to still treat you as a normal person, not handle you with kid gloves, or not make my own lateral decisions about excluding you from things. That sense of normalcy is very important.
It's true.
So that way of radical accompaniment helps. I think personal friends at the individual level as well as maybe at the level of the church community to be eloquent in the language of lament is very important. And we've talked a little bit about this, not to deny that the illness is there, not to hurry also to fix the person who is ill. Sometimes we unintentionally do that when someone comes and we perhaps say certain things.
Have you tried TCM? Have you done this? Have you done that?
All with good intention.
Yeah.
You know, or we start doling out Bible verses, you know, to comfort. And it's all with good intention. I wonder, and this is a genuine question, I wonder if sometimes by hurrying to not think so much about the bad stuff, to not allow those so-called negative emotions to have their time and space, we actually close ourselves off to all the other ways that grace could show up.
Exactly.
Grace can show up in physical healing, but grace can also show up in terms of reconciliation of relationships. And we've heard stories of that. You know, someone becomes ill and somehow or other that becomes an avenue for family members and friendships to be renewed. Because that sense of mortality. Sometimes the grace comes in the form of personal sobering. Wow, my life is so fragile. You know, how am I really going to make my choices from here? Which is the experience I've had, sobering. So sometimes if we hurry a little bit towards the celebration and, you know, the claim, the victory type triumph things.
There is definitely place for lament. We have the Psalms of Lamentations in Scripture. We have entire book of the prophet lamenting away. There's definitely, of course, grief is real to all of life, all of us.
Yes.
And of course, life is full of waiting. But waiting well is hard.
Yes.
Waiting well
Not
is hard.
Not to lament as complaining,
yeah,
but to lament in a way that we are led out of bitterness into comfort and into again returning to focusing on God.
Yeah. So before we go, what are two things you would like to leave with us that lupus has taught you?
Two things I think that lupus has taught me 21 years. The first is a daily fidelity. And fidelity in the sense of living faithfully, but also living in high resolution.
That's a good way to put it.
Because of the whimsical nature of lupus, where you really cannot tell when, you know, it can be very unpredictable, the symptoms coming, and exactly where is it going to hit you this time, it can change. There are many days where you wake up and you don't feel exactly right. You know, the wiser thing to do is to just put a halt or slow down on everything that you're doing. How do you be faithful on those bad days when you really feel so much nothingness?
Right.
Yeah. So I've learned through many rounds of this happening that the sensible thing to do is to rest, physically rest, and then also find emotional and spiritual rest.
Yeah. And that's being faithful. Just being faithful to the life God has called you
exactly.
to.
Yes, exactly. And rest is an active strategy.
Yes, it is.
It is an active choice that you make. I've been quite affected by the writing of Marva Dawn in this respect. She has a book titled Being Well When We're Ill.
Yeah.
And one part of the book she writes that in a time of infirmity, the illness is the work.
Right.
The illness is the work that you're called to. All the sensible disciplines that come with it in terms of taking care of your physical body, but also then your life with God, especially.
And you are honouring your life and your body. The very thing God created and entrusted you with.
Yes.
It is actual work. Yes, very good.
And going back to that earlier point about how God does use all the material of our life. So even in a time of illness, when you feel as if you are not very much, you know, what use is this? What use am I when I'm ill like that? Your faithfulness is just to whatever is happening in that moment, in that situation. And also I've learned through those periods of nothingness that God understands what is it to be nothing. In fact, He chose to be nothing.
Right.
So He deeply understands that sense of being wasted in a way. And yet He is also the one who holds everything together every day.
Wow, that's really good. That is a paradox that's very hard for us to understand, isn't it?
So I don't really fully understand that. And I'm glad that it's beyond my understanding. Because if God was totally within my understanding, I think that's not a very good sign. So there's daily fidelity in terms of faithfulness, but also daily fidelity in terms of high resolution. This goes back again to lupus being unpredictable and the necessity of paying attention every day when I wake up. How does my body feel? Do the joints today feel tighter than they did yesterday? Is there a part of my body that does not feel quite so right? You gain this sensitivity. You're calibrated quite well. And in order for myself to remember and to see the patterns, I write things down. So I think that stomach and the muscle for journaling and all that comes from also many years of writing down the clinical results, writing down symptoms that I observe. Your doctors can only do so much whenever they run tests at the medical center with you. You are with yourself every
day. You are documenting your own story.
Patients have a responsibility to pay attention to what's going on. So that learned attentiveness, which might have begun with something like lupus, I think has pretty much extended to being a personal discipline or habit.
As well as your vocational, your professional life right now. The ability to pay attention and to listen well, which is the core skill that you said in visual recording.
So the inner attentiveness as well as external listening, both are very important to understand what's going on and to see God at work.
Yeah. And I think we come back to my observation of you as someone who lives with a certain exuberance, like you say, high resolution. And I think after this conversation, I really understand why. Thank you so much, Wendy, for coming to share with us. God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening in. We hope you've been encouraged with some new thoughts on faith and life integration. You can find us on the Cathedral app, iTunes, Spotify, or at cathedral.org.sg/podcast. Be sure to join us again.